Dr. Tom Ellis, and so I was out for that occasion. But I'm delighted to be back this evening. Take your Bible and join me in the book of Song of Solomon, chapter 5. And tonight we give our attention to verses 2 through 8. Song of Solomon, chapter 5, verses 2 through 8. A passage that we've entitled, How to Avoid a Bad Night in the Bedroom. Song of Solomon, chapter 5, beginning with verse 2 and studying through verse 8. The Shulamite woman speaks, I sleep, but my heart is awake. It is the voice of my beloved. He knocks, saying, open for me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is covered with dew, my locks with the drops of the night. I have taken off my robe. How can I put it on again? I have washed my feet. How can I defile them, or probably more accurately, how can I get them dirty? My beloved put his hand by the latch of the door, and my heart yearned for him. I arose to open for my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the lock. I opened for my beloved, but my beloved had turned away and was gone. My heart leaped up when he spoke. I sought him, but I could not find him. I called him, but he gave me no answer. The watchmen who went about the city found me. They struck me. They wounded me. The keepers of the walls took my veil away from me. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him, I am lovesick. The London Observer wrote on January the 9th of this year, lawyers can't cope as divorce epidemic sweeps the United Kingdom. An outbreak of matrimonial millennial madness has led one of Britain's leading divorce law firms, Lloyd Platts and Company, to refuse to take on any new clients. Said Vanessa Lloyd Platts, quote, if couples continue to separate at the current rate, there won't be anybody left to divorce in 10 years. Feminist writer Natasha Walters, in sizing up the situation, argues, quote, this means people don't want to put up with second best anymore. Marriage isn't keeping up with the way we conduct our relationships. And what I see much more of is that a lot of men and women are looking for love, but not necessarily within the framework of one partner for life. Julia Cole, a spokesperson for Relate, said that the beginning of a new century had prompted a new scrutiny of relationships. And she pointed out that sexual problems, always uppermost in people's minds, seem especially widespread. And she says, and I quote, there is an expectation that along with the perfect lunch, the perfect presents, the perfect New Year's Eve, there will be lovely, perfect sex. The contrast between expectations and reality is often enormous. Obviously, it is the case that far too many people are experiencing significant disappointments with their marriage, and often those problems do find their way into the bedroom. Now, I want to be clear this evening. Most problems in a marriage do not start in the bedroom. But unfortunately, far too many problems eventually find their way into the bedroom. And no marriage will ever be everything God designed and intended if the marriage bedroom is not a place of happiness, a place of rest and refuge, and a place of joy and satisfaction. The author of Proverbs reminds us in chapter 5 and verse 18, let your fountain be blessed, and rejoice with the wife of your youth. Now, I find it interesting to note that the author of Proverbs did not say the wife in your youth, but the wife of your youth. In other words, she is to be the same wife with whom you joined yourself 10 years, 20 years, 40 years, and 50 years later. And one of the interesting things we're finding out is that when we again accept and adopt this type of sexual relationship and this type of marital relationship and put them together, We find indeed that God was in the process of giving us the very, very best plan possible when it comes to the intimate part of marriage. In February of 1999, the National Health and Social Life Survey completed a rather detailed survey on sexual habits of Americans, and they discovered some very interesting things that were reported in the Journal of the American Medical Association. First of all, they discovered that single active people have the most sexual problems and get the least pleasure out of sex. They also discovered that men with the most liberal attitudes about sex are 75% more likely to fail to be able to satisfy their partner. They also discovered that married people by far reported the happiest satisfaction with their sex lives, and I find this utterly fascinating, the most sexually satisfied demographic group of them all turned out to be married couples between the ages of 50 and 59. Now that's good news, especially for those of us that aren't 50 yet. And yet, according to some additional research, I've got some better information for you. November the 29th, 1999, a news release noted from the University of Chicago that when researchers set out to discover which religious denominations have the best sex, they learned that, and I will quote the article, "The faithful don't do all of their shouting in church," close quote. Conservative Protestant women, their survey found, reported by far the most intimate sexual satisfaction of any group. Indeed, 32% of all evangelical women said that they experienced sexual satisfaction every time they made love with their husband. As you moved into the mainline Protestants and Catholics, they dropped 5 points behind. If you are involved with no religious affiliated group, you drop down to 22%. And the article concluded, Unitarians may not wish to read any further. Well, folks, the fact of the matter is, Newsweek may run a story in the first week of the first month of this new year that was entitled, "Was It Virtually Good for You? Sex. The best lovemaking of your life is now just a few nanobots in a bodysuit away," touting the virtues of techno virtual reality sex. And yes, also at the beginning of this year, the magazine Cosmopolitan may challenge us with what they called, and I quote, "Cosmo's 20 favorite sex tips ever," which claims, and I quote, "You will have the wall-shaking, earthquaking moves that'll make your bed end up across the room." And by the way, that was one of the more tame titles that I came across, and probably even there came close to crossing the line, didn't I? However, based upon what I just said and what I've just shared, the fact of the matter is, if you are really looking to have the most enjoyable, intimate life possible, find you a born-again mate and keep them until they're 50, 55, or 60, and then and there, you'll find the most enjoyable, intimate relationship this side of heaven. And yet, let's again be honest. Far too many couples are suffering the hurt and disappointment of too many bad nights in the bedroom. And so when a bad night comes, when things don't work out well outside the bed and therefore lead to things inside the bed not being happy, what are we to do? Well, I am not surprised that in the Bible we have exactly this situation spelled out for us with crystal clear clarity in Song of Solomon chapter 5 verse 2 through verse 8. And I believe as we walk through these verses this evening, we will see four principles that will help us understand how it is that we can have in place a strategy that will keep us from having too many bad nights in the bedroom. Number one, you should understand the desire for love may fail sometimes. Why? Surprise, surprise, because of bad timing. Just bad timing. You get off wavelengths with one another. Shulamite, Solomon's wife, is in bed. The text says, "I sleep, But my heart is awake. Some commentators believe that she may have been dreaming or she may have been half awake, but it seems clear that she is tossing and turning out of anxiety and disappointment. What is the issue? It's quite simply this. He's late again. He's not home. And she's frustrated. She's disappointed. She's probably even angry. And so she has gone off to bed alone by herself, and she is not happy with the situation. The text would seem to indicate that Shulamite herself had been anticipating a happy and a exciting night of romance with her husband, but here he was out late again, and all of her desire and all of her dreams had been dashed. Now, why did this happen? And what is it that caused this particular bad night in the bedroom? And what is it sometimes that causes us, you and I, to have a bad night in the bedroom? Well, first of all, work may cause the problem. You notice there in the text it says, it is the voice of my beloved. He knocks saying, open for me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one, for my head is covered with dew and my locks with the drops of the night. This is an example, that last phrase of Hebrew parallelism. My head is covered with dew, my locks with the drops of the night. What he's simply saying is, it's late. Perhaps near midnight or after midnight, like many men, he's been out working late. He's been struggling to make things come together. After all, it is a cruel world that he lives in as a king trying to lead the nation. Sometimes being a king, sometimes being involved in work requires long days, and sometimes those long days grow into the nights. And so when the days turn into nights, time gets eaten up, and the time that is given to work is now taken away from the wife. And gentlemen, I would remind all of us this evening that you get to spend time one time. And when you spend it over here, you can't spend it somewhere else. And on this particular occasion, work won out over the wife. And so the stage is set for a confrontation, a showdown in the bedroom. So work may cause the problem. But now secondly, words may not cure the problem. I would point out, first of all, that in the ancient Near East, interestingly, it was the custom for a man and a woman, if they were wealthy and had the large, spacious home, it was the custom for one to have one bedroom and another to have a separate bedroom. And so here in the text, Solomon is coming home. He walks into the house. He finds the Shulamite woman, his bride, his wife, nowhere to be found. So he makes his way to her bedroom. He may be tired, but he's not too tired. And so he moves toward her in need of emotional, in need of personal, and perhaps in need of physical and intimate attention from his wife. And indeed, we are coming to understand more and more and more how important and how significant the intimate part of marriage is for a man. Indeed, it is the very root, at the very root of the foundation of his most basic needs. A recent report said, quote, for men, the secret of a happy marriage is emotional support and an active sex life. While women would just like their husbands to take more interest in them, women said, they just want their husbands to take a greater interest in their opinions and a more active role in their social lives. But the report goes on to say, sex plays an essential role in building up a successful marriage. And this counselor said, and I quote, we have seen newlyweds who do not have any idea how things work, and we have some middle-aged couples who are either too lazy or too tired. Now, whatever the reason, you have a very unattractive and not so pretty picture that emerges, and again, as a result, there is a bad night looming and on the horizon in the bedroom. Now, I have words of criticism for both Solomon and Shulamith in this text. Solomon probably rightly deserves to be criticized for coming home late. One gets the impression that this is not the first time that this has happened. Yet on the other hand, the Shulamite woman cannot be commended for her behavior. Indeed, she acts quite selfish and she acts quite self-centeredly. And the fact is, Solomon evidently is aware that there's a problem. I might add having a locked bedroom door might give you the impression that there was some hostility on the other side. And so Solomon does what a wise man would do. He tries to get to the heart of his bride through her ear. And so what does he do? Well, you'll notice there in verse 2, four times he uses the word my, and he attaches it to a beautiful designation or a beautiful word of comment or a beautiful pet name for his wife. He says to her, he knocks saying, open for me my sister, which emphasizes the friendship aspect of their relationship and the permanency of it. Open for me my sister, my love. This is a word that is used nine times in the Song of Solomon, and always it's on the lips of Solomon. It speaks of one in whom he takes great pleasure and delight, and often the word appears in the context of his complimenting her attractiveness and her beauty. So he says, open to me my sister, open to me my love. Again, he says, open to me my dove. Now, we have seen previously that the idea of the dove, especially as it is attached to the eyes, speaks of peace and tranquility, of gentleness and tenderness. Some Bible teachers even believe that by now in their relationship, it has become something of a pet name, something of a nickname that Solomon has attached to Shulamith. And so he calls her his sister, his love, his dove, and then he says, my perfect one. You're flawless. You're blameless. There is absolutely no defect in you. Now, folks, I am absolutely convinced that Solomon was sincere in his compliments and in his words of praise. He was not putting on a show. He was not just trying to get her to open the door. He was not just trying to get back on her good side. He genuinely and truly meant what he said. Of course, we need to be honest this evening. Sometimes that's not the case with men, is it? Sometimes men are just as guilty of using code phrases or just as guilty of saying things they really don't mean as are women. Recently, a radio station here in Louisville ran a series of interesting editorials about some differences that exist between men and women. And on one particular editorial, they ran some different sayings that you often hear coming out of the mouth of a man that actually means something very different. And I made a catalog of them. For example, when men say it's a guy thing, what they really mean is there's no rational thought pattern connected with it, and you have not a chance at all at making it logical from your perspective. When a man says, can I help with dinner? What he really means is, why isn't it already on the table? When a man says, uh-huh, sure, honey, or yes, dear, it really means absolutely nothing. It is a conditioned male response. When he says, it would take too long to explain, he really means, I have no idea either how it works. When he says, we're going to be late, it really means, now I have a legitimate excuse to drive like a maniac. I personally like that one myself. When he says, take a break, honey, you're working too hard, it really means, I can't hear the game over the vacuum cleaner. When he says, that's interesting, dear, it really means, are you still talking? When he says, that's woman's work, he really means, it's difficult, dirty, and thankless. When he says, we share the housework, he really means, I make the messes and she cleans them up. When he says, you know how bad my memory is, he really means, I remember the theme song to F Troop, the address of the first girl I ever kissed, and the vehicle identification number of every car I've ever owned, but I forgot your birthday. When he says, oh, don't fuss, I just cut myself, it's no big deal, it really means, I have severed a limb, but I will bleed to death before I admit that I'm hurt. When he says, hey, I've got my reasons for what I am doing, he really means, and I sure hope I can think of some pretty soon. When he says, and this may be the all-time favorite, I can't find it, he really means, when I look into the refrigerator, I can't move the milk jug, because if the ketchup is not behind it, then the milk jug won. And when he says, what did I do this time, he really means, what did you catch me doing? And when he says, I heard you, he really means, I haven't got the foggiest clue what you just said, and I'm desperately hoping that I can fake it well enough so that you won't spend the next 3 days being mad at me. Now, folks, let's be honest. Sometimes, guys, we are guilty of saying things we don't mean. We just sort of give a reflex response, hoping that we can just sort of coast and get through the situation. I don't think that was true of Solomon in this case. When Solomon says to her, open for me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one, he meant what he was saying. But sometimes the hurt can be so deep. Sometimes the disappointment can be of such a nature that words may not cure the problem. And so understand that the desire for love may fail because of bad timing. Now, number two, understand that the details for love, well, they may seem like too much trouble. Verse 3, Shulamite says, I have taken off my robe. How can I put it on again? I have washed my feet. How can I get them dirty? Shulamith is mad. She's hurt. One of the most basic needs of her life, her husband spending time with her, has not been fulfilled. And so as a result of that, she responds in a not too friendly and not too loving fashion. You have this in your notes this evening, but Bob Turnbull, in an article entitled What Women Really Need or What Your Wife Really Needs, points out that there are four things in particular that a man must provide for his wife, or she will dry up and wither on the inside. He points out, number one, she needs time, the currency of a relationship. Your clearing space in your calendar for her says, you are valuable to me. Evidently, Solomon had not been able to do this. Shulamith felt like she was not important. Secondly, talk. This is how she connects with you. It is also a way that she handles stress, where men, on the other hand, tend to walk, take flight, and try to hide somewhere. They handle stress much, much differently than do women. Number three, tenderness. Tenderness feeds her soul. She is nourished, and she knows that she is cherished, and it speaks to those inner needs of her heart. And then she needs touch. And sometimes, guys, and I know this is hard for us to understand, but the touch needs to be non-sexual. It needs to be affectionate, but it doesn't have to be sexual. And when we do that, we let her know that we value her as more than just a sex toy or a sex partner. If every time you touch her, you almost immediately want to move on to sexual activity, you will make her feel cheapened in the relationship. And rather than build her up, it will tear her down. Rather than speak to her heart, it will wound her heart. Now, whether Solomon intended to or not, it's quite clear. He failed this 4T test, especially the first one, time. Now, again, I want to be clear. This does not justify the way Shulamith responds. Just because he made a mistake doesn't mean she has the right to fire back with him and make a mistake as well. And indeed, I see here in verse 3 her being guilty, number one, of nothing less than a silly priority. She says, I've taken off my robe. I can't put it on again. I washed my feet. And of course, they had floors that were far more prone to be dirty than ours. Sometimes in certain homes, the floor was nothing but dirt. How can I defile them? If we were to translate this into the 21st century, what she was basically saying was something like this: not tonight, I've got a headache. Not tonight, I'm too tired. And interestingly, the text says there in verse 3, I have taken off my robe. Several Bible scholars that I read believe there may be an intimation here, kind of a jab in his side, of the fact that under the covers now she lays there naked. And so in his mind he envisions her on the other side of a locked door, under the covers with nothing on, and it's her way of saying, this is what you've missed. You stayed out too late. You stayed out with the guys. Your job was more important than was I. too sad, too bad. There's not going to be any fun or any activity for you tonight. And folks, any way you slice it, this is a very silly priority. You must guard against them or you will have bad nights in the bedroom. But secondly, you must also guard against being a selfish person. Now, yes, washing the feet was an Oriental custom. It was something one would do before eating a meal or retiring for bed. And so what Shulamith is saying here is, I'm clean, I'm prepared, and the idea of getting back out of bed, putting on my robe again, getting my feet dirty again, that is just too much trouble, and you're not worth it. Too much trouble, and you're not worth it. Now, folks, again, at the root of her decision is selfishness. And selfishness is absolutely a cancer that will eat away and destroy any healthy marriage relationship. It is a deadly sin, and a sin that will do irreparable damage to a marriage, and one that at all costs must be avoided. She is looking not out, but in. She is not looking to the needs of Solomon, but she is now looking only to the needs of herself. And I understand sometimes we get hurt. I understand sometimes we get bruised, and sometimes we get disappointed, but you absolutely must not ever let yourself become so self-centered and so turned inward that you lose sight of the needs of your mate. You know, one of the great inventions of this century, without any question, has been the computer. And the computer has been an absolutely marvelous and wonderful device in many, 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 many ways. But one area that it has not been such a great and wonderful device has been in the area of family and marriage. In fact, one of the fastest growing arenas of adultery and extramarital activity is the computer and the internet. You might find it interesting that in the book Letters of the Century, America from 1900 to 1999, where 412 letters were compiled to show something about how our century progressed from the very beginning to the very end, the very last letter was selected from Shirley Glass's AOL Electra column, and it was picked because it was said it captured best the last decade and illustrated the complexities of the computer age and how they have changed us. Listen to the letter that was written to Shirley Glass. Dear Dr. Glass, I met an interesting man online a couple of weeks ago and have talked to him on the phone several times as well. He is enchanting, charming, and everything I could possibly want. The trouble is that I'm already married and all the way across the country from Mr. Wonderful. I really think I'm in love with this man, but what can I do? Sincerely confused and charmed. Well, listen to the wise and direct counsel that Shirley Glass gave confused and charmed. Dear confused and charmed, your Mr. Wonderful may be somebody else's philandering husband. Internet relationships create a romantic mystique because you can create exciting fantasies about the other person. Add a little dose of secrecy, emotional intimacy, and sexual innuendos, and you've got a full-blown emotional affair. It is easy to be charming when you're not dealing with the everyday irritations of leaking roofs and noisy kids. The love that you feel for this man is based on romantic idealization, whereas your marriage is based on reality. Furthermore, stable long-term relationships are seldom as exciting as stage one, the honeymoon relationship. What does your online search for companionship and romance indicate about your marriage? It indicates you need to talk to your husband. Talk about your wants. Talk about your needs. And together, try and find some energy and put it back into your relationship. Selfishness and self-centeredness is absolutely death to any relationship. And understand, when the details for love just seem like too much trouble, you're headed for many bad nights in the bedroom. Number three, understand that the denial of love may flower only temporarily. Verse 4, Shulamite says, "My beloved, he put his hand by the latch of the door, and my heart yearned for him. I arose to open for my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the lock. I opened for my beloved, but my beloved had turned away and was gone." Six times in verses 2 through 8, Shulamite calls Solomon beloved. She will call him beloved four more times in verses 9 and 10. There's been a change of attitude, hasn't there? Before she was angry, but now she is not. His tender, gracious, kind words have worked. They've made their way through her ear to her heart, and they have caused her heart to turn and to change in her feelings toward her man. Now, Solomon, being the typical male, wasn't one to give up too quickly. And so there in verse 4, you see, he makes one last final move. "My beloved, he put his hand by the latch," or actually by the opening of the door. In other words, he gently places his hand on the latch. And because of the symbolic and poetic and erotic nature of the book, a number of Bible scholars pointed out that sometimes in the Bible, the hand is used in poetic literature as a euphemism for the intimate sexual parts of a man. And if that is true, then of course the latch or the opening in the door would correspond to the intimate sexual parts of a woman as well. And so if that is so, very clearly he has very strong sexual yearnings for her, and now in response she has very strong sexual yearnings for him. But what happens? What is the result of this? Well, first of all, note number one. You may reconsider or maybe regret saying no. It says there in verse 4, "I arose to open for my beloved, and myrrh dripped with my hands dripped with myrrh, and my fingers with liquid myrrh on the hands of the handle. My heart yearns," she says. My heart in the Hebrew mind is used just like the way we use the word heart. If I were to say to you, "I love Charlotte, my wife, with all of my heart," what I'm saying is I love her with all that I am, with my total being. Well, in very much the same way, the word heart in the Hebrew mind speaks of the person on the inside, the real you on the inside. In fact, the NIV says, "my pounding heart." One translator said, "my inward seethe in desire for you." Now, there's an interesting thing we find here in the text. Look at it there with me. It says in verse 5, "myrrh dripped," or "my hands dripped with myrrh, and my fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the lock." Now, there's a question. How did the myrrh get on the lock of the door? Well, there are two possibilities. Number one, Solomon put it there. And there are some who believe that Solomon, as he walked away, left myrrh on the door handle as simply a gentle and gracious and kind way of saying, "Even though things have not worked out tonight like I wanted them to, I still want you to know that I love you." The second possibility is that Shulamith quickly got out of bed, quickly dressed, and in anticipation of finding Solomon on the other side of the door, she put the myrrh on her hand so that she would have a fragrant and attractive smell for her man as she opened the door for him. Either way, they are both anticipating, it seems quite clear, now a night of sexual intimacy, and yet because of bad timing and because she thought it was too much trouble, even though now she has changed her mind, things are not going to work out like either one of them hoped. You know, the fact of the matter is, too often, the bedroom can become a war zone and a battlefield. The fact of the matter is, now listen to me, in marriage, it is seldom, that men and women have identical sexual appetites. That is seldom the case. But the fact of the matter is, a husband and a wife can have compatible sexual appetites, and they can come to recognize this and experience this if they will talk, communicate, and work at understanding one another. Several years ago, I had a friend of mine who does a lot of marriage counseling, and he shared this story with me of a lady that came to see him one day, and she said, I'm in serious trouble. I don't think my marriage is going to survive. So he began to talk to her about it, and she said, well, I want to make it clear. I've been married for 16 years, and I love my husband with all of my heart. But the area of sex has become a battlefield for us, and I just don't think I can take the pressure of it anymore. She went on to say that all he wants to do is have sex. She said, I think he would do it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week if he could, if I'd let him. That's all he wants. That's all he asked for. It's just constant pressure to have sex. She said, if I didn't say no at least some of the time, we would be having sex all the time. And I just cannot, I'm at a point where I just can't take the pressure anymore. Well, my friend is a very wise and insightful individual. And so he said to this lady, I don't know if you would let me give you an assignment that I would encourage you and ask you to adopt and to follow for a week. And she said, well, what is it? He said, well, I want you to go home immediately after we get through talking. And this is his word. I want you for the next week to become a huntress. I just want you to hunt your husband down and be intimate with him, not once a day, but several times every day for the next week. He says, do you think you can do that? Being the typical woman, she said, I can do anything for a week. And so she went home. Now, my counselor friend did not get a phone call at the end of the week. He got a phone call 2 days later. The woman was on the other end, and she said, I'm not really sure what you were trying to get at, but I think your little plan worked. She said, my husband right now is lying over in the corner of the bedroom waving a white handkerchief. She said, for the last day, if I walk into a room, he goes out the other way. I thought he was going to jump out the window just a moment ago. And she said, we have just got through having a good long laugh and a good long cry. And she said, we both feel like real idiots. She said, the fact of the matter is, we don't have identical sexual appetites, but we've discovered we have very compatible sexual appetites. And the reason he was always putting on the full court press is because he thought all I wanted to do was say no. And the reason I was trying to say no as much as I could is because I thought that's all he wanted to do. But the fact of the matter is, the way God made him and the way God made me, though it's not identical, amazingly, we are very, very compatible in this area of our relationship. So you may reconsider saying no. But secondly, you may reap from saying no. Look at verse 6. I opened for my beloved, but my beloved had turned away and was gone. I sought him, but I could not find him. I called him, but he gave me no answer. What happens when a man is rejected? Basically, ladies, men are pretty simple. They'll do one of two things. Number one, they'll walk. Or number two, they won't talk. And often they put the two together and they just walk away and they don't talk. You say, what do you mean by that? Well, they won't fight you. Won't fight you physically. They'll go to jail, rightly so. Won't fight you verbally because you'll whoop them about 99 times out of 100. Women are verbal animals. You're a lot better at verbal combat than we are. And so why fight when you're going to lose? So what does he do? He just walks away. And he just goes into a shell and he pulls back. And he goes in, as John Gray says, into his cave. And he just goes away. And that's what Solomon did. Solomon used his words. Solomon gently approached the door. Strike one, strike two. He said, hey, I ain't waiting around for strike three. And he hit the bricks. And so by the time she gets to the door, it is too late. Now again, ladies, and we'll talk about this more in the coming weeks, you need to also be getting to a point in your relationship with your husband that you understand some of the very basic needs he has. You also have this in the handout because Yvonne Turnbull wrote an article entitled What Your Husband Really Wants, and she notes four things that a man longs to have from his wife. She says he longs for you to be his cheerleader. She points out a man thrives on his wife's approval and praise. Secondly, being his champion. A wife's respect and encouragement lifts a man's spirit and his sense of self-worth. Being his companion. A man wants his wife to be his best friend. And being his complement. A woman is necessary to complete a man. And yet because Solomon did not get this, he walked. And because he did not get this, he would not talk. The fact of the matter is, wounded males almost always go into shells. And husbands do not fight their wives, and so they walk away and they won't talk. Marriage counselor Howard Markham has well said, quote, men don't want to spend their lives fighting, so they start withdrawing. That's a typical pattern of development when we see marital distress. So you may reconsider no, you may reap from saying no, and number three, you may regret saying no. And what are the regrets? Well, number one, you may be alone. And number two, you may be ashamed. Look at verse 7. The watchmen who went about the city found me, and they struck me. They wounded me. The keepers of the walls took my veil away from me. Now, I am convinced that this verse should be taken symbolically. I don't think literally the watchman would have struck the queen. I think rather she is beating up on herself. She feels convicted. She feels bad about what's happened. And here's the neat thing, guys. Solomon was not involved in bringing about this change of heart. God was. He left. Solomon did nothing but act kindly, graciously, and gently. He didn't slam dunk her. He didn't chew her out. He didn't tell her, you're never available when I need you. I never can know what you're going to do or how you're going to respond. None of that. He called her, you saw it. My love, my sister, my dove, my perfect one. He gently approached the door, and when he found the door was locked, he left myrrh as a calling card, and he walked away and left her and God alone. Now, I want to tell you something. God is much better at changing the heart of your mate than you are. The fact of the matter is, you'll never change your mate's heart. It's not within your power to accomplish that, but God can do abundantly more effectively what you cannot do at all. And so she is alone, and she is ashamed, because there in verse 7, she is struck, and then her veil is taken away, meaning the most precious thing to her has been stripped away, and in essence, she has realized, I made a mistake. So what does she do in response? Number four, understand that the drive of love may flame again with testimony. Verse 8, I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, tell him that I am lovesick. Of course, we've seen the daughters of Jerusalem throughout the book. They are this group of chorus women that always appear at the most interesting and strategic times, and here they are again, and she charges them, she challenges them, she indeed adjures them with an oath that they understand some particular things. Now, what is it that she does? Number one, she tells others of her love. Now, here are the right words from the right heart at the right time, and yes, in one sense, to the right person. You say, well, wait a minute, she needs to tell him. She's going to. But remember, a man longs for his wife to be what? His cheerleader. A man wants to believe in his heart, I to her am her hero. And when a man believes that, a man will do almost anything for his woman. A man will stay faithful. A man will stay true. A man will work hard. A man will be there when you need him. If he believes, you believe, he is my hero. Herbert Stein, in a Reader's Digest article, raised the question, what does a man need from a woman? And he said, number one, He needs a warm body in bed to cuddle and comfort him. He needs someone that takes interest in what he is doing. And he needs someone who needs to be needed. Did you hear that last one? He needs someone who needs to be needed. And he makes this statement to this woman: you are irreplaceable at any price. And so she tells others of her love. But then secondly, you tell your mate of your love. What does she say there in the last part of verse 8? If you find my beloved, you tell him, I am lovesick. The word there means I swoon with love. She in essence is saying, I can't live another day. I can't go on another moment without you. As one commentator said, am I too weak or too disinterested to make love to him? Don't you be so foolish. How could I not want more? I have love sickness, and the only remedy for my sickness is my man. And so she tells others, and she tells her mate of her love for him.